Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who examines the politics behind the debate over the stimulus package and the deceitful conduct of Wall Street firms receiving billions of dollars in taxpayer money. Dalit Baum of the Coalition of Women for Peace, who talks about her group's research into Israeli and other international corporate business interests in Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. And Catherine Colbert, president of People for the American Way, who explains why she believes that Karl Rove and other former Bush administration officials should be compelled to testify before Congress and be held accountable for any violations of U.S. law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Newly declassified documents on Colombia show high-level U.S. officials, including the CIA and U.S. ambassadors, were aware of abuses by the Colombian army since at least 1990, including activity by death squads. U.S. government officials had concerns about the tendency of the Colombian military brass to bump up the body count of the number of guerrillas killed since the early 1990s, according to documents released by the watchdog group National Security Archive. During the same period, the U.S. State Department repeatedly certified Colombia's human rights record and boosted aid to fight the war on drugs. A classified Colombian government report on the killings of civilians misidentified as leftist rebels has led to the firing of 30 Colombian army officers and the resignation of top commander general Mario Montoya, who promoted the use of inflated body counts to measure progress against Marxist rebels. The incentives to boost body count numbers was institutionalized under the current government of President Álvaro Uribe, whose defense minister in 2005 signed a secret order creating rewards for capture of leftist leaders, who led to a spurt of extrajudicial killings, according to W radio station in Colombia. Facing congestion and hazardous traffic on Interstate Route I-81, the state of Virginia is looking to boost freight rail capacity through investment in the Crescent Corridor, a rail system that runs near the highway. In 2007, the state agreed to pay $40 million for rail upgrades. Norfolk Southern, which owns the track, says $2 billion in new rail investment could divert a million trucks off I-81, which runs from upstate New York to West Virginia. And the state of Virginia has even bigger plans. It says an $8 billion investment over 10 years could divert a third of all trucks off I-81 to cleaner, more efficient freight rail service. The Obama economic stimulus package, with funding for new infrastructure, if tilted towards new freight rail projects, could help meet Virginia's and other states' efforts to transition truck cargo to railroads. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, full-scale electrification of rail lines could reduce America's greenhouse emissions by 38% and reduce oil consumption by 22%. Renewable wind energy, which is plentiful in plain states, could power trains and further reduce energy usage in the region. The I-95 Corridor Coalition says $6 billion in investments to fix rail choke points would produce $12 billion in benefits from reduced transport costs, decreased congestion on highways, and increased economic activity. For the first time in 25 years, the percentage of union membership in the active workforce has grown, driven by an increase in the number of public sector workers. The Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics reported unions represented 12.4% of employed workers, up from 12.1% in 2007. The ranks of organized labor had been falling for decades. As recently as 1982, unions represented 20% of the workforce. Unions now represent 37% of all public sector workers, but only 7.6% of the private sector workforce. Gains in the public sector were driven by organizing drives amongst teachers, home health aides, and home-based child care providers. Conservative business groups used the report of rising unionization to blast the union-backed Employee Free Choice Act, which allows unions to organize a workplace if a majority of workers sign a union authorization card. Business groups oppose any move to make union drives easier. Stuart Acuff of the AFL-CIO says the new legislation is needed because private sector managers often resist union drives and retaliate against workers who are trying to form unions. Ironically, the deepening recession has led to union gains because non-union companies are more likely to lay off workers since workers have fewer job protections. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
After being sworn into office on January 20th, President Obama's top priority has been to gain passage of a giant stimulus bill. The proposed legislation, with nearly $1 trillion in spending and tax cuts, is designed, at minimum, to soften the blow of one of the worst U.S. recessions since the Great Depression. Despite some concessions made to the House GOP leadership, which included a greater percentage of tax cuts, the Democratic-controlled House approved an $819 billion stimulus plan on January 28th, but without a single Republican vote. The bill included money for job-creating infrastructure projects, mass transit, increased funding for unemployment benefits, health care, and food stamps to assist those hit hard by the economic downturn. The legislation now moves to the Senate, where changes are a certainty. As the White House was preparing to allocate the remaining $350 billion in the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, President Obama and the nation were outraged to learn that the financial institutions teetering on the brink of bankruptcy and taking taxpayer bailout funds gave their top executives $18.4 billion in year-end bonuses, the sixth largest amount in U.S. financial history. In reaction to the news, Senator Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, introduced a bill to limit compensation at any company receiving bailout funds to $400,000, the salary of the President of the United States. And independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is proposing that the Congressional Oversight Panel charged with examining the bank bailout fund should investigate the causes of the economic collapse and be given subpoena power to do so. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who examines the politics behind the debate over the stimulus package and the deceitful conduct of Wall Street firms receiving billions of dollars in taxpayer money.
They're on the House not to have a single member vote for a stimulus package that is really the only hope for putting America back to work at a time when tens of thousands of layoffs are announced every day by American businesses. And when people can see the economy just going further and further off the cliff, I don't know what those Republicans really are thinking, other than being the party of obstruction, the party of no, and really the party of Herbert Hoover, because that's what they were proposing. I mean, John Boehner, the minority leader in the House, said government can't fix this, and the person who responded for the House Republicans to Obama's talk last Saturday said, we've got to, you know, cut government spending and balance the budget. That is Herbert Hoover economics, and that's what got us even deeper into the Great Depression. So they don't really have an answer on the House side. I see on the Senate side that the Republicans are coming forward with a $700 billion plan instead of the Democrats' $800 billion plan. So they're seven-eighths of the way there. Of course, the Republicans want more tax cuts and tax cuts for businesses, which don't stimulate the economy as much as government spending on jobs or relief to the states or greater unemployment compensation and food stamps. So that's basically sticking to the Republican script. But I think Obama is playing it cool. I think he understands that he's going to actually prevail here one way or another, not the full extent to which he proposed, and he should have proposed more at the beginning. I mean, I think that's taking too long also. I mean, we've been drifting badly since election day or before. Bush didn't do anything, and now Obama is a couple weeks in here, and he won't have signed a package. So I think, you know, people are hurting, and the more the stalling is going on in Congress by the Republicans, and the more they're seen as obstructionists, I think the more they're going to lose out in 2010.
There's a lot of high expectations out there that Barack Obama is going to help turn this thing around. You know, that's why his approval ratings are so high around the country among Republicans, independents, and of course Democrats. But it's going to be difficult to live up to those high expectations, is it not? And even if this stimulus plan really kind of raises the basement a little bit in terms of how many jobs are lost or how bad the economy is, that may not register, will it, with the American people in terms of, you know, who's going to get credit and who's going to get blame in terms of U.S. politics?
Yeah, it's hard to know how that's going to shake out. I think because the economy is going so far down so fast that people may not recognize that it would have gone down faster and further had it not been for this recovery plan. But look at Obama's own promises. He says he's going to save or create 3 or 4 million jobs. Well, the save verb there gives him a lot of fudge room because those are jobs that weren't cut already. But look, we're losing 500,000 jobs or more every month. That's going to be 6 million jobs lost if that pace keeps up through the end of the year. And he's only going to save or create 3 million. So he's going to be short, you know, 2 or 3 million jobs as it is. So he's not going to be able to bring the economy back with what he himself is proposing, even by his own yardstick. And I think that may come back to bite him.
Now, on the banking issues, as you mentioned, was it $350 billion that they've got to spend here in this next round of TARP money? You don't have a lot of faith in the team that Barack Obama's installed there in Washington with him. What is the right thing to do? I mean, it seems that it's extremely difficult to wrap your head around what to do in terms of these banks, and especially when you've got a lot of the recipients, these giant financial institutions, spending billions of dollars on bonuses for their top executives.
Yeah, and that's just outrageous. I mean, the thing not to do is to reward these banks by giving them another $350 billion with no strings attached, because let's remember, the banks are the ones who got us into the trouble in the first place. They're the ones who destroyed the U.S. economy and are destroying the world economy. So, A, they don't deserve this money. B, they didn't do what they were supposed to do when they got this money, which was to lend it to businesses or to lend it to homeowners and help renegotiate mortgages. They didn't do either of that. They sat on the money. They rewarded themselves with bonuses. They had, you know, lavish conferences, or they had a lavish carnival display Bank of America did at the Super Bowl last week in Tampa, spending maybe $10 million on an 850,000 square entertainment facility under some tents. I mean, that's not what the money was for. And so why should we give them $350 billion more? I do think the subject needs to come up of nationalizing the banks. I mean, why not just skip the middlemen here? The banks are the middlemen. The government is giving money to the banks, so the banks will give money to businesses. Yet the banks, because their financial balance sheets are so weak because they screwed around with funky derivatives, they are not going to hand the money from the government to the businesses. So why doesn't the government just give loans directly to businesses? Get rid of the banks. Let the banks go bankrupt. Nationalize the banks. I mean, we're pouring so much money in, we're de facto nationalizing them, but we're getting none of the benefits of nationalization, but we're paying the cost. That doesn't make any sense to me.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. Read Rothschild's McCarthyism Watch commentaries online at progressive.org. As more people around the world have become aware of Israel's abuse of the rights of Palestinians, both with its recent attack on Gaza and its violent, restrictive, and humiliating occupation of the West Bank, there is growing interest in targeting the economic underpinnings of Israel's power and control. A long-standing Israeli political organization, the Coalition of Women for Peace, has spent the past 2 years researching three issues related to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land: industries located within the illegal settlements of the West Bank, the economic exploitation of Palestinians, and the companies that help Israel enforce its brand of apartheid. The group has recently launched a website called Who Profits from the Occupation?, detailing the activities of some 200 Israeli and international companies. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dalit Baum, who teaches feminist theory at Haifa University and is project coordinator for Who Profits from the Occupation. She explains how members of her group became involved and what their research revealed. Baum expresses hope that the website will serve as an informational clearinghouse for individuals and groups inside and outside Israel working for corporate accountability, social justice, and labor rights.
We understood that it is not only political or religious interests that fuel the occupation, not anymore. More and more over the years, we found out that there are economic interests involved. Not only that, the occupation itself has an economic arm. It uses economic tools to oppress and repress the Palestinian population. So even though we are a feminist organization that deals with public opinion and we are very adept working with words, we decided we wanted to know more about the economics of it in order to try and change it and influence the economic interests. That's how we started. We started 2 years ago, and we are not economists or researchers. We're just activists. And we started going out to the checkpoints in the West Bank, going out to the wall, the fence, the settlements, taking pictures, asking questions, trying to see around us which are the logos or the companies or the corporate symbols that we can see around us so we can investigate more about who is involved, who has a stake in it. And now we came up with this website, which is just the beginning of a culmination of our work, because we actually have more than 1,000 companies on our database, and we have put online only 200 so far, because we're trying to build a case against each and every one of them and be very careful about documenting all our information and checking each and every fact.
Dalit Baum? What are some of the most egregious things you found in terms of what companies are doing there?
It's important to see that different companies that have different types of involvement in the occupation also require different ways of dealing with them from civil society, the different tools of different responses from us. And it's very important to note that the companies we have online do not constitute a boycott list. It's not that all of them need to be boycotted. It's actually very wrong to think of it that way. There are many, many different actions that can be taken and different ones for different companies. And there are all these civilian companies that make tools and information and technologies and different services that are used in the direct oppression of civilian population, civilian Palestinian population. For example, EDS, that belongs to HP, Hewlett Packard, they have supplied a system that does biometric identification and is used in the Israeli military checkpoints in the West Bank. I think companies should be told very clearly that this is not a reasonable business activity.
I know you're not proposing that all these companies be targets of boycotts, but do you think it's ever appropriate to boycott any of them, like Motorola or Caterpillar, which are involved in construction and security work in the occupied territories?
Oh, I think that is obviously appropriate. What is more important, though, is not whether or not it's appropriate, but whether or not it's effective. So I really want us to be effective as a movement. I want us to be able to change the company's policies and stop the occupation, raise the price on these businesses. As an Israeli activist, it is very, very hard for me to say that you should boycott everything to do with the occupation, because the entire Israeli economy is somewhat involved with the occupation. This is, of course, a fact. Israeli economy has been benefiting from the occupation for many, many years. It has used free land, free resources, free labor, very cheap labor from the Palestinians for many years. And I think Americans should think of it in the same way. The United States has been financing the occupation. You know, you're paying taxes. These taxes are used to send weapons into Israel in order to bomb Gaza. You are involved. That's it. Now, what can we do in order to be effective about it? And in order to be effective, you have to have collective action. You have to have specific campaigns that target things that can be changed and start having small successes and then bigger successes, and then, inshallah, we can free Palestine.
That was Dalit Baum of the Coalition of Women for Peace. For more information on the group's research on business interests in Israel and the West Bank, visit their website, whoprofits.com. www.ccc.org. House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, issued a subpoena to Karl Rove, former top advisor to President Bush, demanding that he testify before the committee on February 2nd about his role in the White House firing of 9 U.S. attorneys, the prosecution of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, and the general politicization of the Bush Department of Justice. But 4 days before President Bush left office, then White House counsel Fred Fielding wrote to Mr. Rove's lawyer, Robert Luskin, advising him that Mr. Bush continues to direct him not to provide information to Congress about the firings in 2006. The idea that former presidential advisors cannot be compelled to testify before Congress and that former presidents have the power to invoke executive privilege after they leave office is hotly disputed. Last July, U.S. District Judge John Bates rejected Bush's claim that Rove, former White House Chief of Staff John Bolton, and former White House counsel Harriet Myers did not have to comply with the congressional subpoena. Mr. Rove's appearance to answer questions under oath in a deposition has been rescheduled for February 23rd, as another federal court in Washington considers Mr. Rove's appeal of Judge Bates' earlier decision. The February 2nd Senate confirmation of President Obama's choice of Eric Holder as U.S. Attorney General provides hope that the new leadership at the Justice Department may reverse the politicization there. But Holder has given mixed signals on his willingness to prosecute former Bush administration officials for their participation in criminal acts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Catherine Colbert, president of People for the American Way, who explains why she believes it is critical that former Bush White House officials be compelled to testify before Congress and be held accountable for any violations of U.S. law they may have committed in the firing of U.S. attorneys or in other areas of law breaking, including the authorization of torture, a war crime under U.S. and international law.
Let me just say that we believe very strongly that we not only need to restore justice to the Department of Justice, but we need to investigate to the fullest extent possible all of the alleged wrongdoings by the Bush administration so that people who broke the law can be held accountable and that we can restore to our country the tradition of respect for the rule of law. I think there has been too much of this view that because George Bush was the president, his invoking of executive privilege allowed him to shield himself from the watchful eye of the American public. And we think it's very, very important that we go back and make sure that we have the facts, that appropriate fact-finding is done, that the Justice Department and the Congress take the necessary steps so that we know whether laws have been broken and to hold public officials accountable for their actions during that time frame.
Representative John Conyers, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has subpoenaed Karl Rove, the president's former advisor, to testify before his committee on the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys and the prosecution of former Democratic Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, among other things. Karl Rove has made it plain that under direction of George W. Bush that the former president's exercising, or he wants to exercise his executive privilege to prevent Rove from testifying. So it looks like there's going to be a fight on our hands. What do you think? Where is this going with Karl Rove?
Well, what's recently happened, most recently, and Michael Isikoff reported about this in the most recent issue of Newsweek, is that right before he left office, President Bush instructed former White House aide Karl Rove and Harriet Myers and probably John Bolton, all of whom have been subpoenaed by Congress, President Bush instructed them to refuse to cooperate with future congressional inquiries into alleged misconduct. Now, Rove was supposed to be before Conyers committee to give testimony in a deposition. That deposition was rescheduled in order to allow all the parties to figure out their complete positions. But our position here is that Congress must do all it can to ensure that the truth comes out, that Karl Rove and Harriet Myers and John Bolton cannot just refuse to appear before Congress. They can't give this blanket view that they're immune from questioning. If there is any executive privilege, it's got to be on a case-by-case, question-by-question basis. And frankly, there's a very, very important and difficult legal question here about whether a president who is no longer in office has the authority as a private citizen to invoke that privilege. It seems to me that the sitting president, President Obama, has to decide how far that privilege goes. But the important thing here is what we've got to say to our members of Congress, let's stand up, let's be proud, let's be honest, let's make sure they know that they have the American people behind them when they ask questions and they expect answers.
From what we know, Karl Rove had his hands in lots of nefarious deeds in the White House during his years with President Bush. But what is your top priority? What do you feel is most important to find out, to ask him about under oath in terms of his behind-the-scenes machinations with regard to the firing of the nine U.S. attorneys, the prosecution of Don Siegelman, and other episodes?
Well, I think there's different areas that require investigation. The first is what I think of as abuses, the politicization of the Department of Justice. So we need to know exactly who was hired, who was fired, why. Was politics at the root cause of hirings and firings in the Justice Department? Are there people who are currently serving who shouldn't be there because they were hired inappropriately? Should the people who made politics the basis of hirings pay a consequence for that? The second area, I actually think, is much more complicated and really goes to how the administration adopted policies around the war on terror, issues of whether torture was appropriate, issues of using warrantless wiretapping. Substantive questions about whether the law was abused and the process was abused in promoting policies that violated human rights.
That was Catherine Colbert, President of People for the American Way. Contact the group by calling area code 202-467-4999 or visit their website at pfaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.